In letter 8 of Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth, Christ talks about the concept and the need for remorse. The idea that is, by feeling remorse, not thinking about it, but feeling it, we're going to advance spiritually to recognize that, oh, wait a minute, I don't want to live my life according to ego drives. I don't want to be bashing people and doing other things because it is really unworkable. To try to go through life and satisfy the ego by bonding with what it is we want and rejecting what we don't want, to include other people, not really workable. Recently, I spent a week in my hometown on the eastern end of Long Island. It's a small village, primarily tourists now, but in my day it was fishing and farming. That still goes on. There are wineries now replacing some of the potato fields. But what's interesting about a small town like that is everybody knows everybody. And in my town, because we were a large family and we basically all look alike, everybody knew us. That's kind of good from a safety standpoint. You know, couldn't really commit too many very bad crimes because, oh, I know you, you're a Costello. So that was cool. Interestingly, which seems weird to a lot of people when they talk about their schools that they've attended, is Marianne and I went through to all 12 grades, actually 13 and counting kindergarten, in the same building. So kindergarten through senior in high school. Same building. That's the same building that stands today. And you go, okay. So this is what, we went through school, then we went away to college, and I'll specifically speak to me, that I came back, and then I went to the U.S. Army, and then came back, and after a few years, moved away for good. Last year, June, because my sister-in-law was struggling with the death of my younger brother, and Marianne's brother was struggling with cancer for the fourth time, we went back up to New York. And my older brother John encouraged us to buy a boat with the idea that it would serve as a hotel room, which essentially cost $500 a night, two-night minimum, anywhere even 20 miles away from where we wanted to be. So within the hour of that idea surfacing, we owned a boat. And it's really been very excellent, serving as a second home at a very, very reasonable price with no real estate taxes, which is a very big problem up in that neck of the woods. Prior to that time, I never really returned to my hometown for more than a few days at a time, primarily for funerals or weddings or baptisms. Because when I returned, I didn't really get good feelings. In fact, got a lot of bad feelings. So I was pretty much trying to stay away from that emotional minefield. A couple of times, I skipped class reunions, high school class reunions, even though I was the class president. So over time, I've manned up. I had more courage, so I've attended those things over the last 20 years. And even family reunions, which I would attend, and they were primarily organized by my younger brother George, who saw the need for family. He was the seventh out of seven children. For years in between last year and maybe the year before and way back when, I used to say the only place I liked less than my hometown was Birmingham, Alabama. I once spent 4 days there on a business meeting and did poorly and had regrets about that and didn't have good feelings. There's something about the energy there, largely my energy, but also Birmingham. So I said, other than Birmingham, I like every other place in the world I have ever been to better than my hometown. So you can kind of get the feeling that there were images and emotions in my hometown that led me to get triggered or re-stimulated, so I tried to avoid it. I noticed last year, and I noticed again this past week that I spent up there, that when my attention went to a person or a place, and of course in a small town, you've got lots of images, you've got lots of experience, there have been lots of events and lots of things in which I got engaged or exchanged energy with, but I noticed I felt a lot of regret or guilt many times during that week. It would surface, and I don't think I felt remorse, even though even a year ago I knew that was really important to my development. I didn't feel remorse because I think when this stuff started to come to the surface, I turned my attention away from it before I really could go into it deeply. So I'm guessing now that remorse doesn't really occur unless you'll allow yourself to fix your attention on an object with intention and courage to hold that space and to feel whatever energies were locked into those images. And this past week, I didn't hold that attention. I just noticed it. It brought me to the subject today. Really, the title today for this talk is Trail of Tears. Trail of Tears. Not a reference to Chief Joseph and Nez Perce when they were forced to migrate north, 100 years ago or so. Not that. Although I'm starting to believe that maybe this Trail of Tears is a necessary concept for me, maybe for others as well. So when I look back at what I was noticing in Greenport, I'm quick to say I'm not liable to eagerly volunteer to feel emotional pain. When I start to look back, I realized even from early childhood, I used my mind to put protective armor around myself deliberately so I wouldn't feel pain. At some point along the line, I think there was a very clear decision when I was about 14, and it actually occurred earlier, but at 14, I went, I'm way too sensitive. I don't want to feel this stuff. I need armor. I don't want to feel these emotions, and I think the Iron Curtain around me came down about that time and made me much more difficult for other people to deal with. I could annoy the hell out of them, but I was basically impervious behind my armor to be hurt by them. So I hurt them, they couldn't hurt me, and I thought, this is the way to live. Wasn't that many years later, but I realized that's that being behind armor prevents joy or happiness or any number of wonderful feelings. It may prevent pain, but it prevents positive sensations as well. When I look back, I'm guessing that I was trying to protect myself from a lot of feelings of being less than or not enough. I tend, if I write those words out, I capitalize L and T, less than, or capital N and E, and not enough. I think this plagues many of us, and maybe is what the ego is feeding us all the time. We're less than, we're not enough, and then we get on this treadmill of trying to satisfy the driving needs without regard to other people, and we just keep doing it and doing it and doing it. But at some point, we arrive at a Sunday like this where I'm talking about the downside and the damages done by those kind of behaviors and that kind of thinking. When I was younger, and frankly I think this may even be true to large an extent today, like many self-centered people, back then I thought, I am the only person on the planet experiencing these feelings about myself, about my family, about life, about my social relationships, and on, and not knowing how the game of life ought to be played to be effective at it. I felt, nobody can be feeling this sense of isolation or this sense of imperfection, because I was brought up as a Catholic, this basic unholiness, you know, I'm not very holy. I'm supposed to be holy, but I am clearly not holy because I know what my thoughts were. I knew what my feelings were. I knew what my actions were. In a small town with six siblings, so the population in the house now has got 9 people in it, 7 kids and 2 adults, like, yikes, and family secrets. One of the family secrets we never verbalized, so it was kind of always lurking in the background, kind of like the proverbial 800-pound gorilla in the middle of a room. My father was an alcoholic. We never, ever said the word alcoholic. Never came up in a conversation that I was a part of. Never. And you go, So these secrets that we had to keep hidden or pretend didn't exist really is a lack of integrity, if it's a lack of honesty. And because it never was talked about, I don't know about my siblings, but I didn't understand stuff. And I think that's largely a male thing, maybe much more so than a female. But these regretful interactions that we couldn't talk about, couldn't come to understand, couldn't grasp that it was a person dealing with an affliction or an illness. My mother was a nurse, so we could have looked at it as an illness, but we just never talked about it. So there we are, steeped in confusion and bad feelings about ourselves and the family and so on. Recently, I've been thinking about and using the word bubble to describe the force field that's around us. I could say auric field, or I could say biofield, but this energy field around us that, and not only us, you and me as human beings, but I think all living beings, and, you know, who's to say, maybe all created things. But this force field, kind of like skin or a cell membrane or the aura, is really designed for our protection. You go, oh, that's cool. That makes sense. And it would be real, maybe like a fence around the yard, or, you know, doors and windows on a house, designed to let certain things in and keep certain things out. And it would be nice if the individual bubbles that you and I had had an outer layer that was strong but flexible and resilient. So, you know, when we interacted, when our bubble bumped into somebody else's bubble or exchanged energy with another person or thing, it would maintain its integrity. And it would be intelligent enough to go, oh, I'm going to let that environmental signal in, and I'm going to not let that one in. You know, that's not relevant, it's not true, it's not accurate, or it's not related to me or you. That would be great. It would be great. But the challenge is that when our self-esteem is damaged or not fully formed, because of in the environment and our own consciousness and the consciousnesses of other people, instead of that bubble having a good outer border or boundary, it in fact can be more like a sieve or a net. A lot of things can get in, and some of which are not desirable, and some things can't get in, some of which would be very desirable. And it makes me think that what penetrated this sieve is, you know, stuff that's really energetically emotionalized and powerful from an image standpoint. That stuff penetrates. It goes right through the net or through the force field, and boom, we can be stuck with it. And other things, you know, the niceties, the compliments, the kindnesses, the other positive energies that are less emotionalized, but nutritionally, you know, from a spirit standpoint, more significant, get filtered out, or they just go through and don't get stuck, don't get held on to. I would think that a child in survival mode, the catch of the day, right? I come from a small fishing village. The catch of the day were more like threats or embarrassments or anger as a result of these kind of feelings that were unmanageable or really unknown and ununderstandable to me. One of the things I recognize looking back is somehow I didn't get the lesson about kindness, simple concept, kindness. And I didn't get the one about cooperation with other members of my family. We all worked as early as we can, you know, starting at 9 years old and almost like full-time jobs at 12. And the same was true of my siblings. So overall, we were productive, earning significant amounts of money. But because we didn't cooperate, we were driven by ego and fear and the survival mode. We mismanaged so many things, to include our relationship with money and with one another. Whenever I come across a reference to the Dalai Lama, I think of the statement or the quote that I heard from him. Kindness is my religion. Kindness is my religion. When you think of that, if that's what we knew, if that's what we knew, how to be kind to others and to ourselves, pretty much everything else could fall into place. But without that understanding, without that awareness, because of survival mode and ego and self-centeredness, it's like, nah, I'm the only one. You know, it's like, yeah, that's a challenge. That's a challenge. And it's big. On these talks and with clients and other conversations that I have, I frequently talk about the boogeyman in the closet or under the bed, because I think it's a valid way that most people can relate to of representing a negative mental image that we've created, we produced it, and now what we produce scares the hell out of us. We did that as children. I think these boogeymen still exist. The forms of them just change. We create these images, and then we become afraid of them. When you start reading articles about the soldiers coming back from Afghanistan or Iraq or Vietnam, where my brother George was emotionally and spiritually damaged, he was a casualty of Vietnam. Took him a lot of years of suffering before he died from it. But the images of the boogeymen now prevalent in those environments are improvised explosive devices, right? IEDs. Something that if you touch is going to wreak havoc, not only on your body, but your spirit, on your mind, on your emotions. And so when these soldiers come back with PTSD and other symptoms, traumatic brain injuries because of the concussive properties of these explosions, you go, wow, they're not really much different than us, more intense, obviously, and really need treatment and not to be overlooked or pushed off to the side and ignored, since they're a societal responsibility, not a necessarily limited to a family responsibility. But when we look at around at our environment and what we're considering, and we feel threats or we feel these boogeymen of one form or another that trigger us into paralysis of inactivity, or they send us into flight, or they propel us into fight, it's like, wow. We can know this. We can see this in other people. I think we can see it in ourselves, whether we've ever been in a war zone that's officially designated as a war zone. A lot of children grow up in dysfunctional families, which are war zones. That's the only way it can be really looked at in an accurately, as far as I'm concerned. And when we perceive, by looking out into our environments, these potential threats, this basic question, how will I react if I engage with this? Because that question so often is almost unanswerable unless we have a lot of experience with an identical situation. We're like, I don't know how I'm going to react. I don't know what I'm going to do emotionally or physically or mentally. And that really is the challenge for us. We can look at our past reactions, and the trouble with past reactions, of course, is when we judge them in the light of today's wisdom. Well, you know, it's Monday morning, let me look at what I did on Sunday. It's like, wait a minute. That's not a fair way to judge. If we use it to pinpoint the absence of what we would consider to be rudimentary emotional intelligence, like kindness that I mentioned, or it could bring to light our egoic behaviors and the characteristics and self-centeredness, and that can exclude sensitivity to other people, we go, well, then there's some value at looking at these past experiences. Not to judge ourselves harshly, but to use it as information about our state of mind at that point, our level of consciousness. I really do think the topic of Trail of Tears is very exciting and very hopeful. I would guess that if we avoid this journey, it means we have filled our fields with so many IEDs and boogeymen that it brings us essentially to a stop, and we need to progress. We need to develop spiritually. Another image that I frequently use is the one talking about cleaning a closet, or let's say a cellar, you know, a cellar that hasn't been investigated for a long time, or an attic that has been a repository for stuff stored over a long period of time. We might have kept things there, stored them there, because we didn't know what to do with them. We weren't able to judge, well, this has got high value, I want to save it. It's, I don't know what this is about, I need to save it. I need to store it. I got to keep this. So we collected a lot of junk, a lot of things, a lot of energy patterns that don't serve us, but because we couldn't evaluate it at that point in time because of our level of awareness, we collected this stuff in those virtual places. As we decide that we're going to clean the closet, the attic, the cellar, what we're looking for now is to gain value from that thing that we've stored. Get value out of it. No longer do we need to avoid it. We can say it has some sort of value, and if I look at it deeply enough, I can extract this value, and then I can let this energy move. Somebody was speaking to me the other day about having to clean the house of her father, who had lived in the same place for 50 years and died about a year ago. She was amazed at what he collected. And my advice to her was to walk into that environment knowing that what she's looking at is valuable. Maybe at first glance, not to her, but to her father, and perhaps to somebody else that would, you know, buy it right up at a yard sale. There's value there. And if she goes in and can look past what looks like clutter and junk, and I got to just throw everything away, but instead search for the value in it that gives her a greater understanding and awareness of her own father, she could be into a wonderful set of experiences. When we're looking in the cellar, the basement, the attic, or the closet, if we can find something that needs to be released, let it go. And specifically, if remorse is needed, and if we can feel it and know, really know, that the ego bonding rejection that caused us to behave in a certain way in a yesteryear is truly an unworkable approach to life. And it's never, ever going to get us to where we want to go, spiritually or health-wise or in relationships or having to do with work and business and prosperity. The ego bonding rejection is never going to get there. Last summer, I spent a day with my brother John when he was calling on clients that wanted him to do work. Since my brother George's death, the work has backed up. They're always too busy to do all the work that comes their way. And he went on these calls, and, John, when can you do that? And he was giving estimates off the top of his head, $250,000 for this job, $400,000 for this job, you know, $75,000 for this job. And I don't know when I can schedule it. I'm sorry. I'll have to get back to you. Just because they don't have enough manpower and skill. They have plenty of physical equipment. They don't have the manpower to do this sort of thing. It was amazing to me. But during that day, I brought up the idea of remorse. Not for John, but for myself. Because of the remorse that I knew I needed to feel with regard to our relationship. The conversation didn't get very long. John entertained it for a little while, but I wasn't forceful enough in pursuing it. I remember some years ago trying to engage John in a conversation about emotions. Like, I am not having this conversation. I am not going to be a party to this conversation. You know, I bet if I had offered him a choice of talking about emotions or being hit with a 2x4, he'd ask me how many times and where was I going to get him, hit him with a 2x4. That's how loaded a subject emotions have been in our family. Like, no way, I'm not approaching that. No way. So I wished I had done it, but I didn't do it enough. We just touched the surface of the topic and then moved on. But I have a new plan for this summer, when Marianne and I and Nikki will spend 4 to 6 weeks up there. When I return home in 3 or 4 weeks, I intend to create timelines, right, worksheets kind of thing, so I can keep track of this stuff and be thorough about it. Timelines, maybe charts, because I'm the one that has the family tree on my computer. I created it. I took it over from John and George some years ago because I'm computer proficient and they are less so, that I could use that to document and feel remorse for anything and everything that comes up, that comes into my awareness as I make these timelines and charts and list it. Besides having guilt and regret that I haven't effectively dealt with regarding the death of my 4 siblings, 3 older sisters and younger brothers, the things I shouldn't have done, the things I could have done, the things I would have done, those sorts of things, I think all have to be healed, all have to be done. And I have 2 living siblings, John and my younger sister, Anne. I don't need to wait till they're dead to start feeling remorse. I want to heal this subject with regard to family. It certainly includes parents. Certainly includes my parents. Interestingly enough, how this is all coming about, that in July, on July 18th, Marianne and I have our 50th high school class reunion in Greenport. The following day, there is an all-class reunion because we have a small high school, instead of other classes being able to muster enough interest, they kind of have a cumulative class reunion. They had one a couple of years ago we didn't go to, but on the Friday night we'll have ours, and on Saturday we'll go to this. So I expect to come across and interact with a lot of people that I have known over my 18 or 20 years in my hometown, which clearly is going to give me a whole bunch of stuff to heal. A lot of images, a lot of feelings to heal. And I certainly will not forget my ex-wife, who lives not far from this, you know, 10 miles away from our hometown. She's the mother of my three children, and her family all need of healing from my point of view. They can have whatever feelings they want to have. I certainly know I have a whole bunch that remorse will be in order for. When I was considering this, I thought, wow, 6 weeks, huh? 6 weeks. Hey, maybe this is like Jesus going out into the desert for 6 weeks. Maybe 6 weeks is like a magic number for a person trying to cleanse their consciousness and get greater enlightenment, some greater spiritual awareness, some insights that are not available to somebody who will only superficially look at things that have been bothersome. So it's like, well, I certainly don't expect to arrive at Christ consciousness in Greenport this summer, but I would certainly be open to healing a whole bunch of this stuff that has been in my field, ignored, pushed, or denied, you know, avoided for whatever reason. So I want to take the Christ example and put up with and deal with and be courageous enough to spend this time healing. The thought had also occurred to me that not only do I want to heal my remorse, or through remorse, the pain that I cause other people by, I'll say, my allowing my ego to drive me and to collide with them without regard to them. I was like pretty much like playing demolition derby, whereas other people weren't. You know, if you're playing demolition derby and other people are walking around or being civilized, they're really at a disadvantage. So I want to heal that. But I also want to cleanse my consciousness of the list of negative characteristics that Christ lists in letter 6. All those behaviors are ego-based, and these weapons of ego, criticism, sarcasm, judgmentalness, rejection, denigration, enmity, intolerance, hatred, jealousy, aggression, violent impulses, thieving, falsehoods, double and devious dealings, and slander. Those weapons are what the ego says, and in my case, what the ego used excessively to meet its needs, to try to survive, to defend my individuality. Yeah. I'm thinking, that besides the rampant four-driving needs, that the images and events that deserve remorse will involve most of that list, most of that list of negative characteristics. Letter 8 reinforces the value of walking what I'm calling the Trail of Tears, and it is real valuable. In the PDF, these paragraphs are on page 23 and 24 of letter 8. When the voice of the ego has died away, there is no need to seek security, for you are secure. You know that you are sustained maintained, nourished, protected, healed by divine life consciousness, no matter what others may think of you. Your joy, gladness, happiness, personal fulfillment, and contentment are all inside you. In fact, you no longer need otherness at all. Except you are a part of all otherness. And when the light fills you, you have a driving need to render to others all that divine consciousness is pouring into you every moment of the day as you keep in constant touch with the beautiful dimension within you. No longer do you reject the personality of others. Everyone is acceptable to you. Everyone is in need of love, and now you have plenty of that to give. No longer is it a struggle to love unconditionally. It comes spontaneously. Whatever faults you may have left, whatever mistakes you make in your attitudes to others as a result of the remnants of ego left behind, these are revealed to you, but you do not shy away from self-knowledge, but rather embrace it with love and thanksgiving. You discover that recognition and acceptance of the negative human reactions in yourself is both wholesome and healing. You happily accept and take responsibility for whatever mistakes you make, and then when you have discerned the loving way, you let it go. You will experience inner peace knowing that you have learned something else valuable which will stand you in good stead when you next are challenged by earthly experience. The time for deep remorse is over, since it has now done its work of releasing you from the magnetic emotional responses to life which brought you suffering in the past. You have now entered what I termed Kingdom of Heaven when I was on Earth. You will find that all your needs are supplied, and you will know that any needs in the future will also be met almost spontaneously. This knowledge keeps you in constant touch with divine life and gives you immense security. With a peace of mind and tranquility comes joy and happiness and a new sense of youthful well-being. Minor or chronic or even terminal ailments will be cleared up, and you will again enter into a new phase of existence. Each time you learn a lesson, you leave something of the human dimension behind you and move forward into a higher frequency of spiritual consciousness. That's quite a promise. That is quite a promise. I think walking the trail of tears to experience that promise will be well worth it. I would like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from letter 8. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness. And as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. It is so. Amen.